Good morning. I'm talking to Frank Rowan again. This is the third in our series of interviews, and it's February 23rd, 2009 already. And this morning, I'm hoping that we'll be able to hear your stories about developing markets. So just to go back a little bit, when we, in our last interview, we had started to talk about your move to Winnipeg and the job you took on there. So maybe you just sort of refresh my memory a little bit about when you moved to Winnipeg and into the marketing side of the Canadian Wheat Board.
So I started with the Canadian Wheat Board. They hired me to be the manager of the Montreal office, opened the first time they had an office in Montreal, where there was the center of the shipping industry. And from there, that shipping industry oversaw the shipments out of Port Churchill, out of the Atlantic ports, and of course all of the major St. Lawrence ports of Montreal, Sorel, Three Rivers, and Quebec, and subsequently Baie-Comeau and Port Cartier were built during those years. And it was a very interesting time in the development, because I was in that office for 5 years before the Seaway was built and for 5 years after the Seaway was built. So saw, witnessed, and was part of the great expansion of Lakers coming into the from Thunder Bay into the St. Lawrence, and then ocean boats also going, and then exports of Canadian grain through elevators. And
so when you moved to Winnipeg, then it was a change in responsibilities.
Yes, the Wheat Board brought me out to Winnipeg in 1963, and I just have some notes that remind me that. And I was appointed then sales manager of wheat. We really don't sell wheat. It's customers that buy it from us, more so. And that was in 63. In 1967, I was appointed general sales manager. And in 1971, was appointed special representative sales policy. In this latter capacity, I assisted the Canadian Wheat Board in numerous projects related to the transportation and sale of Western Canadian grain. In addition to these duties, I was named the coordinator of Eastern Grain Movement in March of 1974. That's what I had a lot of experience in Montreal of receiving the grain. This was now overseeing the shipments out of that to those ports.
So that would be coming out of Thunder Bay to the...
Principally to Thunder Bay.
So if we go just... if we start with the first sales position you had, how did what was your job there when you were working in sales? What would a typical day look like?
Well, basically, there were a number of companies, primarily international companies, with offices in Canada, that were accredited exporters. They are the ones that had the export markets overseas. The companies that operated within Canada, companies that we're familiar with, were operating country elevators and terminals and that. Some of them were involved in the domestic market, but none of them in the export market. So there was accredited exporters here, a number of those exporters.
And can you remember some of the names of the companies that did that exporting? I think Richardson was one.
At one time, prior to the war, but not after the war.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And they had offices here, and they had offices, and they had different markets.
The export agents had different markets.
Oh yes, and they couldn't service from Japan to the UK, to Germany, to Poland, and all of these countries. Just to give you an example, there was one company, Agro, a company in Montreal that was established. This is somebody, Mr. Strauss, who was born in Germany, and he and his dad and his uncle had in Holland, were importers of feed grains and other things into that market. And he moved to Canada when the war started in 1939, established a company. And he was turned out to be very successful. Then there was Alfred C. Toper, a big German company in West Germany that handled primarily into Germany.
And were they most of these companies in Montreal?
They had offices in Winnipeg.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Then there was Cargill, who was before they owned elevators and that they were the only Americans. They had an office. A major exporter was Continental Grain, a company established in Belgium originally. And these companies, like those, had vessels of their own. They had their ships. And if you were an importer, they could supply you Australian wheat, Argentine wheat, Canadian, American, whatever. Big, big time.
Mm-hmm.
Louis Dreyfus from Paris, who had originally, can you imagine that from their beginnings, when the time of Napoleon, when he invaded Russia, they all moved with horses and they're down at 1,500 miles. They were assigned that they found the oat supplies in different countries to have them available for those horses. So it shows you when they started. They had their own bank, their own fleet. And at one time they did, in their history, it's an amazing history. They found in Bulgaria is a country just on the Black Sea, below the others. Which is growing all types of it, like a garden. They have a Valley of the Roses there in that town. I've been there once in it. Anyways, a small part of their business was bringing some. First, that's why the perfume industry is in Paris. They bought from there now. There's flowers and they extract the. And that was one of their sidelines in those days, imagine. And they were an exporter here. They helped us a lot. Pacific Grain, this was a Swiss company, had different names. Company's name was André in Switzerland. They were Pacific Grain on the West Coast. They were called Range Grain here. They had a company in the United States under, but they had different names. They had European Grain and that. And they exported in different markets. They were one of the first ones into China that I remembered in my time.
How would you get to know these people? Like, did you have regular meetings with them, or?
Well, there were representatives. They each had an office here. Some of them, the representative they have was European. Some of them hired local people. So subsequently, as I traveled to certain countries, I knew, having from the shipping, where they delivered grain. So if I was to visit some of those countries, I would certainly communicate with the local chap, tell him I was going there, and so that he could let their office know, or the importers that. So in sales, I had a pretty good idea of where their business was, but that were no statistics, but they did most of the export. So there were companies like Pacific Rim. XCAN was a company formed by different cooperatives here to do business into Japan at one time.
The pool elevators?
Hmm?
The pool elevators?
Yeah, there had been no business to Japan before. And so some encouragement was given to the pools about getting involved, but they were a bit reluctant, but they formed an office under the name of XCAN, and an inexperienced chap who then, they opened an office in Japan at the time, because we had an embassy there and facilitated it. And there'd been no business to Japan prior to that. So they got started, and wheat was something, but then the Japanese in time imported, became big exporters of rapeseed, which is now canola, and other things eventually. So they remained, but when the pools were bought out, I mean, it literally, but XCAN operated for quite a few years and mm-hmm. into that business.
So where did the wheat board have sales offices? Do they have sales offices around the world?
No. They're the people. These are the people that sold. We opened an office in Tokyo, and quite early, which is very important.
Was that before?
That's a different market altogether. Not before the war. They didn't import anything from us prior to the war. They didn't even have flour mills, I mean, or anything else, right? That's quite a story how that developed.
Tell me the story of how that developed. So before the war, they didn't import any wheat products or grain products from Canada. But things changed.
I was hired in Ottawa. Well, my story after the war, when I came back, I returned to university, and one of the specialties I did was in transportation, particularly interesting. I had worked on vessels and in the summer prior to that, and some knowledge. And I started working with the Canadian Maritime Commission, which was responsible for shipping and shipyards, and very, very interesting at the time. There had been no exports from 1939 to 1950 because of the war, prior to the war and after the war, was aid programs. And then there was a big demand. The exports really started off of different products in Canada. And so each company was making requests of the railways for more and more cars. There was a lot of confusion, so the government appointed a transport controller, Mr. R.W. Milner. And I was seconded to that office. And this was trying to find out really what the exporters want, what did they have, and what, not in too much detail, but exactly how much did they need and how much did they handle, and assisting this so that the railways could find out, not actually what they had to move in series. So this was very interesting. And one of the big items, naturally, was grain, with 5,200 elevators and shipping to all of these features. So I was... But this Mr. Milner had been born in Ontario. His dad was, I think, head of Maple Leaf Milling. After the war, Mr. Milner came out to Manitoba to get involved in the grain industry. He noticed then that there was all with the horses and wagons to bring the grain to country, elevators. He had been in transportation in the military, so he started a trucking business here to see if it would do. But that's quite a story. Subsequently, he moved out to Alberta, and he was with Alberta Pacific Grain. And at that time, Alberta, they grew grain, but they were furthest from Thunder Bay, and they got the less. And so, like some of the others, particularly in himself, thought that if there were other markets, there was an elevator built in Vancouver the first time that they operated. And they had the first shipment of wheat, not them, but the first shipment went to the UK via, because the Panama Canal had been open after the First World War. But there were many Chinese people and Oriental people in Alberta, and practically in every little town, as they had come when the railway was built, and they had laundries and they had different things like that. So she had asked, among others, asked a number of them what did they eat back then, and they talked about noodles. And he never could, I guess, figure out what that is, which is a big industry today about noodles in those countries. And he said that he knew that you can't change people's eating habits or what they eat. And at conferences with other Western farmers in those days, there weren't that many on the Pacific Coast that thought the same as him. So they thought that they were part of a campaign that they shipped flour to Japan to make bread and make sandwiches for school children. And they started to learn, this was a program that they had, got aid of the parents.
Who had the program?
Alberta Wheat Pool, with people from the States, an organization, a farm organization, the Farmers Union, and other big co-ops, and they proposed that at that time, and that was quite a thing to go to the Japan in those days, not even knowing the country. And that program started, and the Japanese noticed after the end of the war, only in limited places, but those that had been raised on wheat had started were more robust than that. So immediately they decided then to inquire and build elevators. And they immediately, right after the end of the war, and today they have the most modern elevators. Ours way out of touch. And from that time they only import the highest quality wheat, only number one, only of high protein. As I said, they built our milling industry was so behind the times that theirs was the most modern in the world, I would say. I visited some of those companies later, since we had an office there. One of the major ones was a Mr. Shoda, a very, very nice man, a big Nippon from Nishin Flour Mills. His daughter married the crown prince, was the first time a girl like that, so he was the father of the... They came here, and his wife in 67 to travel, very nice. So that's how that market opened today. And Japan has been to Canada the biggest importer of wheat, and they buy every week the import admission. They only take the highest quality wheat. It's as if you had a big arena, they have all the box seats. That is the major trade, high quality wheat. Subsequently, they started importing rapeseed, but more and more canola now. And those are the big markets from Canada, but the wheat, they are the number one. They take at least 100,000 tons a month. And that is a private trade, but controlled by the government and the food agency, because being on an island and subsequently they purchase from different countries, maybe not necessarily wheat. They take, it's the only market that the United States ships spring wheat to. They grow limited quantities, but that's all the Japanese will take. So dark northern springs, wheat like ours that are grown in the Dakotas and that. The American, if they wanted that market, they have to supply this spring high quality protein wheat. But they buy a lot of corn from the States and other markets and that. So Mr. Milner was originally, at the beginnings with that, with the programs of sending flour to the school. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the big, big market developments, how that went to that.
So when the grain products leave here, where do they go to in Japan? Like, what ports do they... Do they have a port, or?
Oh, 120 million people on the planet. You're talking about big time operation. It's in limited areas, huh? Because other islands have the traditional food that they have. A wheat for making noodles, as I told you, that there's large quantities of. That the and they produce wheat as well, a different type, but not of the high quality wheat on those various islands, and self-sufficient. So if you bring it in, the wheat is for the main big cities, I guess, on the major islands. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Japan is Canada's biggest customer?
The number one customer. The highest quality wheat, and they're buying every week. Mm-hmm. They call tenders, and they have quite a system. I mean... And so every Japanese ship that is taking wheat has brought cargo, other cargo here, whether it's televisions or whatever, and automobiles. They're the only ones that have got their two-way trade. And since they tender, and wait 3 months ahead of when they need the wheat, these companies get part of that traffic when they have traffic to meet with their schedules. All the different companies are an integral part of taking cargo from Australia or from United States, bringing cargo in and out, and they're the only ones with two-way traffic. Very clever, very clever.
Who are Canada's other big customers? Or has that changed over time?
It's changed a big time.
So when you first started, who would be?
Well, compared to that, well, the UK. Until the mid-30s, before we could export any, we had to people from here would go to England, give them approximately how much we produced, what the quantities were, and they would say, indicate how much they needed from the Atlantic and the port. And I guess they also might have had veto on that if we were exporting to other countries. It depended almost entirely on that. The mother country, they were always expected.
And how did that
change? Because of a belief from the grain exchange in 1936. I just saw the minutes of them having to go to the UK and to...
almost get permission.
Mm.
So that
and
changed.
And then, of course, then during the war, I mean, we were such big suppliers, a small population. But... there were about 120 places where they were producing, turning wheat into flour, even small places on the Hutterite colonies and everything else, all to go to Halifax and on cargoes going to the UK during the war. And then after the war, in the early to the 50s, was aid programs, Europe and other things like that. And so the millers here had a Klondike, I mean, all they could produce.
And then what happened? To the UK market.
Oh, it remained until, what do you think happened? So we were shipping to Germany, but I bought from Canada in the early 50s after the war, and started with aid from Belgium. We'd get vessels delivered. Until the European common market started up. When they started primarily at the beginning for, they developed the coal companies in the war. Instead of competing among themselves, they formed a market of doing that on the common market, which made sense. But somebody then came up, what about agriculture at one time? I said, why should we be dependent on other countries to do? So they started producing grain and asked countries around the world for ideas of varieties that they should, the different seeds that they have. And they went for high yielding forms of wheat. At one time, France produced more wheat than Canada.
When was this? Like,
in the 60s, not before, oh, no. Quality-wise, it wasn't what we had, huh? Ours is a spring wheat. But as far as yields were concerned, and the policy of subsidizing the farmers was based on yield, they had a price set at Rotterdam, and whatever you grew it, I mean, if it's 300 miles away or that, I mean, you got the subsidies that they had for producing. And it got so big that they had so much grain produced, I mean, they were literally giving it away to even market shipping from the common market out to the Far East.
And what was it used for? Like, was if it was not as high quality?
They found all types of ways of using it.
Mainly feed or mostly
some
food?
No, some bread. There are great varieties that grow wheat that are not ours is to raise, but flatbread and pita breads and others that are like in the Middle East and everything else. They do now, but they're limited markets.
So how did Canada react to that then, one of their major...
Like our friends to the south, it'll never work, the common market.
So much they knew. So how did Canada sort of adjust to that? And were you working at the wheat board at that time when there was sort of the shift in the build-up in the common market?
But there's not much that we could do or any attempts were made to do it. And what the big development that came here was the year that I moved to Winnipeg in 63 when the Russians came.
The Russians are coming. How did that come about?
Well, in marketing of grain, finding markets, and mid-50s, I guess, in 56, 57 or something, those countries. Poland came from Eastern Europe, were interested in importing wheat. This is a country that had been devastated. I mean, it was big agriculture. That's where the war was, the first shots of the war, where the Germans went and the Russians came. And so they approached, and at that time, basically, a special formula was made and negotiated with them that they could buy grain on credit. They would pay approximately 10% down and the balance of three portions of in 24 months or 3 years. And that worked out very well. We started very easily with Poland and that sort of. So once they did, subsequently we got markets, then that came Czechoslovakia, came in to imported some wheat. the wheat into East Germany. And then in the late 50s, Russians came for an agreement like that, just to have an agreement, and they imported small quantities of wheat going into Leningrad and that. But from Poland, Czechoslovakia, and those, it worked out quite well. And became, any of them would say they would like to buy at Polish terms, just a term. Even when we went to China, they were familiar. So they were familiar with it, and then, as I say, when they were a big Russian trade in 1963, the year that I came to Winnipeg. It was quite interesting how that developed in Ottawa, but I don't think we want to...
Oh, I would like to hear.
Yeah, you might be interested, but the other countries... But the Russian trade mission came to Canada, and Mr. McNamara, our chief commissioner, had been at the International Wheat Council meetings that were held in London, and the Russians were part of that because they imported and were exporters to the UK of really high quality wheat. They had higher quality than we had. So he had met the people from Export Lab in Moscow, Mr. Malveev and the others. So he saw that they were on the delegation that came to Ottawa for trade. So it was a slow time at the time. So he went to Ottawa and met with them. He has a lot in, as it turned out, both of them had a lot in common, and they were very straightforward. And the discussion that they had, Mr. Malveev asked a lot of questions of how much we produced and how much could we sell and what ports could handle, and they got talking to quite a bit, and he quoted a certain figure that McNamara said, under pressure we could just ship that much. He said, I'll take that much. And the other one realized, you know, he had... So the next day, Mr. McNamara went to see the deputy minister, and minister pointed out this. And so it's evident that it could take a lot, but he said, we can't do that. I mean, that's what we can do. But the British and all these other buyers usually take so much a month, and they haven't booked there. But so we have to protect the position of doing that.
You had to keep your previous customers happy.
Yeah. They did not have a chance here to sell out the whole thing. Anyways, I was involved towards the point of getting questioned by them in Winnipeg, how much could shipping handle, and if we got it unloaded and everything, did a lot of logistics on that in general. Depending, I says, if they sent ocean boats that could take it up. Anyways, this was all worked out, and they explained to Mr. Medvedev that we can do so much, but that it's got to be. We have to protect traditional customers now. So they took 5 million tons. This was in addition to all the exports that we had to any other customers. So you're asking when the first big break was. I mean, this was about all that we could deliver, flat out, or the railways and whatever.
So it's not just a question of saying, well, yes, you know, our farmers can produce that. You also have to think about, can your railways get it from...
The basic one, the hell with that. Well, the basic one was he wanted it starting that September. It, never mind what they were producing. What did we have? What could we do and get it moving? I mean, he's not telling us 2 years ahead of time. That's another opera, that the producing has to do with weather and everything else. So for the first time in history here, we had, in addition to what our traditional customers are, what they were shipping. Naturally, it wasn't all going to their country. So you're asking about market development. They were exporters, even to the UK, as I said, of high quality wheat. Higher quality than ours as far as protein content. So then that was part of the discussion. Here they were shipping grain, wheat and flour to Cuba. So whether we was any problem with taking Canadian wheat instead of them shipping from Russia and all the distance and everything, here going to Cuba. And then some of their other countries that were nearby, like Poland and Romania and others, produced wheat that they would sell to Russia next door neighbor. But these countries, Poland and Romania and others that grew wheat, had big crops and they were certain of shipping to Russia, but they didn't have space to store all of that grain. So what they would take, if that wheat was good, the Russians would take it at the beginning of the year, and then the wheat that we had shipping to them traditionally over the months of November, December, January, February would go to those countries. So we knew where every one of them went to, and some to the Far East and to the big quantities to the Far East.
So let me get this straight. I'm getting a little confused here because so they would buy Canadian wheat, and then they would end up selling Canadian wheat to other places. We would fill the gaps.
I never mentioned that.
Okay.
I said they take it from those other countries and they replace it by buying from us.
Oh, okay. This is fascinating.
It's just trade.
Yeah. It's not simple though.
And I was at the center of the whole thing, keeping the records. You should see the records that I have downstairs. I went over 40 times to Russia.
So what would be, when you went to Russia, describe a trip to Russia. What kinds of things, why you would go, how things progressed when you were there. Tell me a little bit about their system. Like you were mentioning Japan's system was...
You realize that Russia has 10 time zones. We're
yes.
talking Halifax to Tokyo.
And did you visit every time zone there?
Oh, No. I went once. I'm very concerned. From here, in 3 days, 3.5 days, I went through 17 time zones. That's another, the Vladivostok and the Nahotka. I have pictures downstairs of when I went there. That's quite a...
How would you describe their grain handling to ours, for example?
Oh, no comparison. I have no idea. The spring, you see, they were distributing to different republics. At that time, it was the Soviet Union. So they were putting wheat into Latvia and Estonia, Lithuania, and Moldavia, and these different republics, which they don't have to do now. And but they and within their own country, I mean, even getting grain to ship out to the Far East. We're going over 6,000 miles by rail.
And was there, like, their markets in the Far East, were they, like, the communist countries in the Far East?
No.
It was
Russia.
Just anybody?
No, Russia goes from Poland to the Far East, which is Russia.
Okay.
The republics were all on the outturn. Today, Vladivostok is still an old part of Russia. And that's 10 time zones from 9 from Moscow.
Why, what changed in Russia that they suddenly became such a big customer of Canada, you know, from very little sales to this major
sale? Oh, they saved themselves a lot of money.
How?
When they had to bring from the center of Russia to ship wheat to Cuba and flour, and so they were going to other destinations, which I'm not mentioning, that our wheat then went in replacement that they took to others. They saved a lot of time. To bring grain from 6,000 and 7,000 miles by rail within their own country, when they could take wheat off from Vancouver. And they had ships that off the Pacific Fleet that serviced their far north. And during the ice season like ours weren't, so those ships were coming into Prince Rupert and bringing wheat and then to the far east of Den instead of them shipping. It logistically, it made a lot of sense, and they saved up big time money. Mm-hmm.
So was there somebody in Russia who finally said, aha, we're doing things wrong?
No, I don't know.
You know, we could be doing this better?
I could see from the logistics of what the shipping was. Mm-hmm. And then, in any event, that has made our whole big changes in our grain handling system here at that time. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we went to hopper cars at the time. Huh? That yeah, the money took the money from that contribute. That was a main start of it. And then each province had been making so much that Saskatchewan bought some and all. And once that started, then no need for country elevators or storing. And we didn't have one thing. In the old days, we have to fill the terminals at Thunder Bay and fill the Lakers and that. Meant the banks made a pot full of money because it all had to be financed. And those houses were financed, just paying storage. Now the grain stays on the farm. The farmer saved making a lot more money, and it was all deducted from the price of the wheat. So everything in Lake Boats, all that 80 million bushels at Thunder Bay, financing that at the expense of the farmers and the paying the storage. This way they can ship it from Brandon by car to Montreal. Should see the trains that go to the east in the winter. Back within a week, 10,000 tons from Brandon to Montreal, and the cars are back in a week's time.
So why do they even need the stopover in Thunder Bay then?
They don't. That's a different market now.
So
earlier, Thunder Bay was built big because of big trade that we had with the United States.
Tell me about the big trade with the United States.
Well, there was one year that they shipped 60 million bushels of oats through Thunder Bay to Buffalo. 60 million.
Usually feed grain or feed oats or?
At that time, before the horses, to feed horses and of all kinds. And that was designed at that time, prior to that.
So even the growth of the automobile had an impact grain sales.
Well, the whole Western Canada, all the harvesting was done with teams of horses. One company, Burt Saddlery, that just supplied equipment for horses, had 1,200 locals across Western Canada.
Down to one by the time.
Yeah.
By the mid-70s, I guess.
Yeah.
So I've read a couple of things about the great grain robbery. What's your experience with that? What did that refer to?
That's the title of a book and the chap that wrote the book. And to sell the book,
yes. A good catchy title.
Yeah. Not against us, I know. Yeah, I'd have to refresh my memory. I know about it and everything else like that.
So we had Japan as a major.
We had Russia. We had the UK was a major market. high-quality wheat through Churchill and that. Norway, and then when Poland came in the mid-50s, it was developing. And then what happened with the common market, eventually we got out of the wheat. And by that time, there was the big, big change, that the dramatic change from rapeseed into turning it into canola. And that was done by scientists here, great research. Rapeseed was starting grown during the war, as they needed a certain fine oil that they needed. And the rapeseed, I think, that we had was imported at the time from Argentina or something like that. So it was continued after the war, but they could get the oil, but the meal couldn't be used. It had a very bitter taste, and the animals didn't want to eat it. As the oil is good, but the meal is a major part. Like in soybean, we get soybean oil, but the meal is worth a lot more for feeding animals and everything. So scientists here made a big profession. They were able to extract or change the erucic acid in that, and so that the meal then from canola can be used for feeding, and it's very, very high quality for feeding. Not only the oil they want, but they want the meal as well, as if not more. It's worth more than the meal. So as it developed, we started from rapeseed, and now we get canola as a major, major producer. Then there are developments like the Red River and Assiniboine flooding over the almost each year, and the water goes out each year. They did produce wheat in that land for years, but it was not good quality wheat. Mm. So subsequently, they made the changes once they found it'd be very good for root crops. They started sugar beets, and now it's big time at peas and lentils and of all kinds of other in those areas. And along the Assiniboine now, between Portage and Carberry, they produce over 5 million tons of potatoes. That's more than New Brunswick or Brea, all of the former land that they produced wheat. So those are changes that came along.
So the if we look at the other sales that, or even changes in sales made over the time that you were at the wheat board, there was the big shift to Russia.
That is of wheat and certain barley. But then there became other grain products, and they get the priority to transportation on rye, flax, rapeseed, and that. And any demand, they get the priority, the private companies, as far as the transportation. So then we started to export of malting barley.
Who were our customers for, where do we sell our malting barley?
Well, the biggest buyers at the beginning south of the border, Anheuser-Busch and Coors and those, and certain varieties. And now some went to Japan, some high qualities went to, not much, but one or two cargoes to Belfast for the Scotch industry.
I bet they didn't let people know their stuff was coming from Canada to go into Scotch whiskey.
And they've been doing a long, long time, you know, in the 30s and everything. But principally south of the border, yeah. And different varieties of malting barley and that. So that they get the
market. How did that, I think you had some connection there with sales to China. How did that develop?
So when I was in Montreal, in the Montreal office, one of the exporters, one of the major exporters, on high quality wheat that they purchased, they'd have to let us know the destination where it was going, because we don't run through that. But on wheat that graded number 3, 4, 5, It's still very good wheat, but some of it maybe not high protein or damaged by frost or something else like that. They could sell to any destination.
Who's the they?
The credit exporters.
Oh, the exporters, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nobody sold but them.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the team of ministers saying that we sell in a country that bought. And told us that he'd sold a couple of cargoes to China. He didn't have to announce a destination or anybody who wanted to inform. So when I was in the Montreal office, they called through the wheat board and they told me that a member from a delegation from China were coming to Canada via the east. Since we didn't recognize them or the States and they couldn't come in by the west, so they crossed the whole of Europe and into Montreal. I met them at Montreal airport and brought them to a motel at Place Louis Riel where there's a kitchen and I have photographs of them here with Anita and my sister-in-law. So they had other commodities that
looking for markets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So today I was in my office was in the Montreal Board of Trade or something. So I went to certain companies. Who were in charge of that? Could they fit up on my appointment for them? But they wouldn't go to Ottawa or Winnipeg.
Why would they not go to Ottawa or Winnipeg?
We didn't
recognize them.
Wouldn't give them visas to travel, maybe.
So they could land, but they couldn't travel.
So later that year, just before Christmas, at the end of December, we got another message that was another delegation coming. So I went out to the airport to meet them, and on the way in from the airport, I heard on the radio that Mr. Howe had died in Montreal. They'd like to meet our chief commissioner, who I said, certainly I'll come in and let you know. But I said, I came back and told him he's out in Vancouver. It's holiday season and he's visiting his mother. But in the meantime, I told him that Mr. Howe passed away, which he'd seen. So he said that he'd come to Montreal on the pretext of going to the service. After the service, he brought the Deputy Minister of Trade and Commerce to the hotel to meet the Chinese. We didn't recognize him, but we brought the highest civil servant.
Who was it? Do you remember?
Yes, I know. I'm not able to tell. So I made the arrangements and took them in. So about 2 weeks later that they asked, or less than 2 weeks later, for people to go to China. And two of us, I went and the manager of our Montreal London office. Imagine in those days, huh? It's called my mother-in-law. So it was a long trip, a propeller aircraft. So we were about 2.5 to 3 weeks in Hong Kong. And anyways, that was the first major contract was signed. And the beginning of it. The key then was Canada didn't recognize him even. anyways, quite a story about how that went about.
So how did it come about that we got had the Chinese signed up? Was it easy sales negotiation?
They knew everything. They waited for us to tell them. They didn't need to have us. They knew the Polish terms. They knew all the terms of those contracts. So eventually that's what they had to do. And to give them credit, it had to be signed by the government. In other words, they would, because the government were... So they signed an agreement to give them credit and bid that was signed by the government people. And the following week, Alvin Hamilton, minister from Saskatchewan, went to Hong Kong. Never met China, but met the office there and came back and landed in Canada, which was good, out of the airport and showing with a contract in his hand. Subsequent ministers like Mr. Argue and said, well, what kind of contract is it? I said, I didn't accompany him, I wasn't there. And that was the first of the long-term contract signed with China at the time.
And they've continued to be a major...
Yeah, well, you know, the country runs from Churchill to Venezuela in China. And so they don't have that much, in those days, the transportation within that country. And so they do produce an awful lot of wheat, as much as the Americans, and all in the northern part of the country. The south is in mainly rice and other things in the interchange. So I know where the wheat does go by ship or where it unloads it. I went to one port, Tsingtao, up north that in those days, to see a vessel unload. You have good clients, and works out perfect. This is wheat grown on the top parts of the prairies, and most of it get through Prince Rupert there. So that would be big help.
So any new markets that you sold to, maybe not as big, that bought from you, right?
Well, we produce durum wheat, which the product is semolina, and from semolina is pasta. And in North America, there's some grown in the Dakotas and that. Here, they're grown in Saskatchewan, certainly. A major producer is Argentina that produces, but they're in the old days. There's a market for primarily, all we know is about is Italy, but southern Spain, southern part of France, and others are importers for products that they make, pasta, different types of pasta products. A major producer is Turkey, but they don't keep it segregated with other wheat, so it can't be used. But so some years there's a big demand, there's shortage, and the prices would skyrocket, and the next year the farmers would grow a lot more, and the price would come down. And that was the secret of durum. So... my interest was always in shipping. When vessels left Montreal, I would look at Lloyd's calendar as a ship. When a ship was named, I'd look up in Lloyd's where the ship is coming from, where it had been in the last year or 2 years. This was my interest all the time. So France imported durums from us. Three companies imported durums, three exporters here. And I'd look up where they went, and I saw the ships would unload in North Africa, in Annabaw, and Mustaganem, and Oran. And it didn't bother anything to me that this was okay for them. And so then in 1968, we were in, really, even the Russians bought durum and everything. So I asked permission to go to Algeria. We didn't have an embassy there, but I'd seen ships, our durum unload for years. So naturally, the three companies that were exporting here, they were exporting to an importer in France. They didn't have the ship, nor were they. They didn't care less once it got paid where the ship went. But I asked them, I was going to Paris, I'd like to visit these companies, which I did. and just told him I was glad to be here, that I was coming here. And I was planning to go and maybe visit Algeria. Oh, so we have an army. Here's who we contact with. We'll let them know that you're coming. As if I landed there and not tell them that we're down in hours, they would know somebody from the wheat port right there. Instead of this way, oh yeah, we had lunch with the guy. So this is, I went in 68, there was no Canadian embassy, an attaché in Switzerland. All in French, huh? That's my first language and everything.
So that was helpful, that you were able to speak French?
Mm-hmm. So I thought it was quite a story anyways, that we then signed an agreement a few years later. So I went at least once a year from 68 to 88 to Algeria. And then from time to time to Morocco and Tunisia because they buy there. But Algeria is a big importer that they produce durum wheat a lot. But just like our crops are damaged by frost, theirs are crops are really damaged by the siroccos, the hot winds off the Sahara that come along. I was there 1 year and I sensed that they had 55 degrees in the desert.
That's Celsius, I think.
So that was a big market. And another one that helped introduce it, that over the years, Canada Food Aid to the CETA, but all our aid is distributed by the World Food Program. And if we could deliver it to different countries, trying to find out what they needed and everything else like that. This helped a lot in finding certain markets that knew our wheat. A very good experiment. Canada has been very wise in that. We don't do bilateral aid. Other countries give aid and they get other things in return. Ours, the World Food Program, distributes. We know where it goes. We get credit for it. But we're not
expecting a...
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of a tit for tat.
Yeah. Other things, not selling arms and all these other things.
How important is a country's reputation for sales? Is it strictly business, or does a country's reputation make a difference in whether you're successful at selling or not?
We're successful. General, we have very good reputation, particularly the quality of the wheat. The inspection system here is very highly maintained. The Grain Commission laboratories that test the grains each year, the reports are very, very helpful. The rest of it, we're a small player, compared to the others.
Small player compared to the United States?
Well, in a common market today. I tell them, that don't us. California has more bigger population than we have. and changes over the years, the big, big changes here in production in Alberta. And they had a difficult time. They were growing. Years ago, they were far from Thunder Bay, but then the West Coast. Once they built elevators, and then the trouble, almost year in and year out, there'd be strikes. Once Thunder Bay closed, for some reason, the ports had closed down in Vancouver. Longshoremen for containers or something else, and they'd shut off the grain, and good chances. So Alberta particularly, well, the overall Canada suffered about that for year in, year out. Minister would always ask me, what if you had something to do? I said, to find a solution to that, or the arbitrate. But it had nothing to do with grain most times. Anyways, Alberta and some time back decided what could they do to utilize more of their grain domestically. Which they have a big time, but they're major producers of beef now. And these are big markets that they're doing.
Did you ever?
There's a big plant, a rendering plant in High River. It does 4,000 head a day. The most modern and the cleanest and the finest in the world. Imagine that they, and for feeding once, and, when the minister was here, there was a, we know about our Aboriginals, the problem, but there's a tribe, Southern Alberta, that came to visit the minister here in Winnipeg. And I met with two of the older chiefs, and they had 23,000 calves that spring. So I had a conversation, asked them what shifts did they take when the calves were raising. And they said they preferred it to the night shift overnight. I said, yeah. And I said, they would bring the grandchildren with us, sleep under the stars, and tell them stories about this. And then if cows have difficulty, they're there to attend to them. But imagine 23,000.
Hungry little, hungry cattle eventually, and
but all high quality cattle, all thoroughbreds. And then when I was inquiring from them, I said, "What about all the vets that are looking after the problem? We have all our own." I says, "Yeah." So they have Mormon that live in that area that arrange for Aboriginals to go to schools in Utah. High class. They're about the best that there is in animal husbandry here. And when you look at what ours here, and but those between Thunder Bay and Regina, Aboriginals. Yeah.
So Alberta then is pretty much self-sufficient in feed grain?
Oh, yeah. And it's changed so much now, you know, that one of my sons, Anthony, is an inspector. He started out in Lethbridge, was been with Rupert, been with Churchill, and now he's at head office. But a few years ago, out here at Morris, they have a facility there. I went one day, and that could load 10,000 tons in boxcars from 8 in the morning to 8 in the evening. And half the quantity came by truck from Alberta to unload into that. And those same trucks then loaded feed wheat from Manitoba and took it back to Alberta, right to feedlots. So when you look, instead of the old system from the farm to a country elevator, from that to a feedlot, when these guys can take it from a farm here, feed, and right to a feedlot. Mm-hmm. 5,000 tons unloaded in one day from trucks, and those same trucks then reload. Whenever I hear, I go and see, I'm interested in seeing. That was wrong. I was like a wharf rat in years ago. Everything, see how they do it and what they did. This I couldn't get over, the inspection, and without an elevator.
Mm. So just on the run?
Oh no, an excellent facility. Yeah. No, it's inspected and everything. I mean,
so what do they unload into?
Straight into box hopper cars.
I'll have to
All designed for
I'll have to take a look at that, because that's a different way of doing things.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So that's
why
the changes. Oh. Yeah.
So going back to your sales position, were there ever any situations that kept you awake at night for worry that things weren't going the way they should?
No, the only upsetting thing, that are major ones, is the labor problems, which had nothing to do with this. You know, other part in Vancouver, it was from unions from the States, in stuffing and de-stuffing containers and everything else.
But what does stuffing and de-stuffing containers mean?
The secret of containers, you go to a plant, you put it in the container and you seal it, and they come here and you deliver the container to the importer. Mm-hmm. They wanted to unload, in Vancouver, they wanted to unload the container. And extra handled, and then you get 20% of pilferage.
And so
that the whole secret, the whole success of containers is that that it's put in that container that is not handled and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, you don't do that.
So the
fortunes were lost, and then the work stoppages in Vancouver was the worst thing for years.
And those work stoppages would obviously have an impact on getting the grain out.
And they started right after the Thunder Bay closed, of course. So potential markets at the time, and that's a whole story in itself.
Did we ever default on deliveries? Did we ever default on deliveries?
No, default, it didn't make sales.
Ah. So let me, this is what I'm getting from what you're saying, like this is what I'm learning new, and just correct me if I'm wrong. Canada, you have to have a lot of customers, and sometimes those customers are actually your competition. So that, is that a fair statement?
Well, you know, there's been a big change over the years, that the wheat is good, and derms and high quality malting barley. There's more and more malting barley today than there used to be. A lot of the land, growing a lot of peas and lentils now, and that we were exporting, that none of it was done before. And between Portage and Carbery, now 5 million tons of potatoes that were never grew before. It used to grow again. So we have less of a production.
Of wheat?
Yeah, of wheat, yeah. Yeah, canola's been... Yeah, it's changed a lot. I can't talk about mm-hmm. the last. I'm not familiar with the markets have changed.
But change seems to be sort of the name of the game.
Oh, yeah.
That if you don't change...
Oh, no, they're excellent. Oh, no, I'm not against that. They were wonderful. It's certainly helpful, and good products, and the ideal would be to dealing more free trade than with the South. They would like to buy more here.
South?
United States.
Uh-huh. And why doesn't that happen?
Representation, like the senator from North Dakota and those.
What happens?
It's more difficult,
Trade barriers?
Yeah, not that delays in trade, but I'm not familiar with all the mm-hmm. details.
You mentioned an international grain body earlier on, and I just took note of it because I wanted to ask more about it. I can't remember what it was, the international grain. You were mentioning that they, I think, met in Britain at one time.
The office was in London, that was an international place for the handling of sugar, where exporters and importers would meet, and the simpler. Similarly for grain, there was for years and years.
And it was called the International Grain?
No. And the International Wheat Council.
Ah, okay. And what did they do? Like, what was their reason for being?
Well, it was a meeting, exporters and importers would meet.
And did they deal, or did they...
No. Just the fact that... The head man from South Africa and Austria and others were there, and people from the government here, but like the wheat board would stop in. We had an office in London, because the UK was a major market, but also that keep us in touch with the International Wheat Council. It was a meeting place for them, like that.
Sort of networking.
Mm-hmm. Very, very good. But then, as I say, once the common market had wheat, there's a one for sugar, there's one for other products like that. Yeah, the importers are interested, and the exporters, I mean, a meeting place that if you, otherwise, if you don't.
Any other customers that?
Yeah, a lot came from, as I say, through the food aid program. The countries that started wheating, like Ghana and others, started purchasing wheat that they needed it, and Nigeria and others. But the big development, the exporters, you know, these accredited exporters have found all kinds of markets that they're doing. But now, that was in my time, I bet.
Well, that's what we're interested in. We're interested in your time. Yeah. And big changes since then, of course, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, with you.
See, the ministers aren't even interested. I mean,
I think that's what I've noticed in my reading. That's what I've noticed in my reading.
Now, when you see that in the paper last week.
Earned $708,000, the wheat board head.
That's what they say.
Have to read the article. I take it it's a little different from what your salary was back in those days. Well, just looking at
when I came in '63, I was getting $17,000.
Yeah. Well, things have changed.
Yeah.
I've got.
I know it was good at that time. No, my pension now was very good.
Yeah.
I continued after the board. No. Anyways.
So I have about half an hour left on this tape, I'm thinking that could we meet one more time for the Thunder Bay story?
Because today I have something that I have to the wartime pilots there. Fewer meetings. And
well, we'll sign off on this.
Just so, yeah. They're disbanding.